This is CliffCentral.com. Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan. And Ramon is not present today. I know you were waiting for him to say that. Unfortunately, he's had a family emergency. He's had to run off. As you know, this would be the first show he's ever missed, so it's very unlike him. But he is going away shortly, and we couldn't reschedule at all. And we've got an overseas guest. So he said, please do go ahead. Continue the podcast. You're the better host anyway. And he's going to kill me for that comment. And please just do the podcast without me. So we are doing the podcast without Ramon. Obviously, much happening in the country. The expropriation without compensation narrative continues, driven forward by left-wing idiots in the media and useful idiots, as we've referred to them previously, as well as our radical National Democratic Revolution parties. So all is really not well. I thought it'd be interesting to speak to a guest from the UK, someone I follow on Twitter, someone I've heard speak before, because he's got an interesting take on both conservatism, socialism, and it's important to keep these concepts understood. If you're listening to the show and you haven't listened to some of the stuff we've done before, I'd recommend going back and listening to those podcasts as well. But let's get straight into it. A gentleman by the name of Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Hello.
How are you, man?
I'm very good, thank you.
Great. Sebastian, all right, so just a little bit of background on you. You are studying at the moment at the London School of Economics.
Yep.
Where a whole bunch of your colleagues are studying economics so that they can believe in things that economics doesn't say at all.
There's a fair few of them.
Yeah, I actually came across some of them on your timeline a little while ago. Very, very interesting people.
Yeah, I mean, London School of Economics is interesting because most people are just there to get a good degree and go to work afterwards. So they're not too politically charged, especially not on the wrong side of the spectrum. But you do get the odd crazy, which it makes it fun though.
Well, yeah, I think all universities are, I suppose it is fun. It depends. It's fun until they sort of are in control of power structures, because inevitably they're authoritarian. You must believe, you know, it's wrong think and all of that stuff that comes along with it. So, and all the universities seem at some level to be have been infiltrated for decades in some respect in this way. I'd imagine something like LSE would have been protected to an extent, just because economics doesn't work on the left.
Yeah, I mean, Hayek was teaching at LSE back in the day, and he had all of his arguments with Keynes, who is he's not a socialist economist, obviously, but very, very big on government spending, government intervention in the economy. So you would think that from the tradition that LSE's inherited, it would be quite free market. But I mean, in an undergraduate course, they don't get you charged enough on economics to get annoyed about things like that. But there's the general consensus, I think, amongst the students that think about it, aside from people like me, is that there should be much more intervention. There should be, you know, big-brained wojaks deciding everything that's going to be produced and consumed in the economy.
Yeah. And that's, I think, has seeped down into the general population who generally, when there are problems, turn around and say, well, what is the government going to do? The government needs to fix this. that's the knee-jerk reaction of people. If you stop them for a second and go, what has the government really ever fixed or done properly? They'll say nothing. They'll get that. It is the knee-jerk reaction of many people. All right, so
yeah, it's funny.
You are a conservative in the real sense of a conservative. Just before we got on air, I was saying that, you know, you have a whole party named the Conservatives at the moment, who in their past have certainly espoused conservative views and beliefs, but currently they seem to be swaying quite heavily away from that. Is that a fair sort of analysis of the situation?
Yeah, I don't think anyone apart from card-carrying members is really enthusiastic about the Tories in the UK anymore. I mean, they piss off everyone. They piss off the classical liberals because they implement these sugar taxes and they ban straws. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you take away someone's chocolate bars, they get raging at you and think you're a socialist. And then they piss off the conservatives because they just don't do anything that's... I mean, what are they conserving in this country?
Mm.
They, you know, sometimes you get the odd piece of environmental protection where they don't want you polluting the countryside or something, but that's about it. That's what you can think of really in the public mind.
Yeah. And in terms of, just quickly, in terms of, I know it's not your area of expertise, but what do you see playing out in terms of the politics there? Because you've got I think most people will know this, you've got Prime Minister May, who's by all accounts been quite a dismal failure. Obviously the left doesn't like her because she's the head of the Tories, so they think she's a failure, but I think even the Tories would admit that she's mostly been a failure.
It's her Brexit stuff that's really made her unpopular. Have you heard of this dichotomy between soft Brexit and hard Brexit?
I have, and there's the agreement, the Chequers agreement, is it?
Yes. Yeah, so
just explain that a little bit more.
Okay, so essentially, after it was right after the European membership referendum, European Union membership referendum, that the media and politicians started talking about this soft versus hard Brexit thing. It had never been mentioned before the referendum in those terms, but it suddenly popped up, I think, as a way of just saying, well, we'll go for the middle ground, which is soft Brexit, which is Brexit in name only.
Yes, and that's how we win.
Yeah, and then obviously there are a few obviously there's a lot of different characters playing out in the Tory party. There's proper leavers like Boris, who is always getting flack from everyone apart from, I think, people who find him funny and conservatives, because he wants to leave the European Union properly. Mm-hmm. And then you've seen this basically this evolution of the Prime Minister saying, okay, well, we'll go for this deal, and this one will be pretty hard, and everyone thought this was okay. Mm. And then she came out with this Chequers deal under very odd circumstances. She was away at this basically the country getaway of the government called Chequers, this big country house, and apparently told all of her cabinet that they can either agree to support her deal or they can walk back and get a taxi from the end of this mile-long country driveway. So, and obviously, you know, being politicians, I think most of them just wanted to save their careers. Boris and David Davis resigned. So,
yes.
But anyway, essentially, it's soft Brexit.
Is where you're at now.
Yeah, and no one's happy about it. She's not realised that whatever you do with Brexit, you're going to piss off roughly half the voting population. So you may as well pick one thing and do it well and get, you know, satisfy the maximum number of people. If you try and temper Brexit and Remain,
everyone's,
you're just going to piss off both parties.
Yeah, everyone's unhappy.
Exactly. And of course, you know which side I want.
Yeah. And then what's insane is that that's actually driven people either to be less enthusiastic around her program and the Tories, and has Jeremy Corbyn leading in polls. Obviously, there's no election just yet, but he's leading in polls. If there was an election today, the polls say he would win it. And this is in a month where it's been exposed. I mean, we knew he was friends with Hamas, and we knew that he was heavily anti-Israel, and there's been a lot of anti-Semitism around him, and he's cozied up to terrorists. This was kind of known before, but when you get sort of photographed laying a wreath at the grave sites of the Munich terrorists,
it's extraordinary.
And yet he is the most popular political figure, you know, in office at the moment in the UK. It's quite nuts.
Yeah, I'd love to say that I understand it, and I always try and ask myself what the other side's thinking, but I've tried. I just do not understand how people who claim to be fighting oppression can then support someone who loves terrorists. I just do not understand.
Yeah,
I can't get it. I tried.
It is quite baffling. It's also quite baffling that the same sort of people are sort of protesting Trump when he rocks up in your country.
I love that. You know, they have this massive big Trump thing. So when Trump came on his visit in summer, you know, they crowdfunded this balloon.
Yes.
And it was a massive disappointment. And that shows you how much the left can deal with planning the economy. So if they can't get a fucking balloon right, you ask yourself, well, can they plan an industry? But, so they're all tits up about Trump coming over. Where were they when Erdogan was here? Where were they when the Saudis were here? They're nowhere to be seen. And it's because they're told what to get angry about. And, they hear someone say something that's questionable about women. And to them, that's worth more than state-sponsored terrorism.
Yeah.
Morons.
All right, good. So we got you fired up, which let's get into conservatism, because before we came on, I said to you I'm a classical liberal, which means I'm actually different to a conservative. Mm-hmm. And often there's this sort of thing where the right is lumped together. So if you're a classical liberal, you're on the right. I think that in the current modern day, that would be correct. Certainly. If you're a conservative, you're on the right. But then the problem comes in is, if you're a sort of fascist or a white supremacist Ku Klux Klan person, you're also on the right. So then what happens is you, me, and the Ku Klux Klan guy get put into the same box, and nobody wants to have any dividers in that box and explain like where someone would fit in. The same as no one would want to explain where sort of a moderate liberal fits in versus someone who's now calling themselves a socialist or a social democrat or a communist. There are dividers between those individuals. So let's get into conservatism.
Okay.
Go for it.
Where do I begin?
I don't know. Tell me how you got. How you got? Have you always been this way?
No, actually. So I because of when I was I went to grammar school, and I was always a bit of an oddball when I was there. I like to read quite obscure books, and
so not Harry Potter.
No, bloody hell. Some people's understanding of literature extends as far as J.K. Rowling. They should be shot, in my opinion. But that's beside the point. So I was at the school. I was a bit of an oddball. And to me, libertarianism was just perfect, because it was this idea that you could do whatever you wanted. No mm-hmm. one else was going to take away the benefits that you had made for yourself.
Sure.
And you similarly couldn't do it to anyone else. So I was a big libertarian. And then when I moved school and I started asking myself, what is it that's valuable in a nation? What is it that you would actually seek to protect? And it struck me as, I just asked myself a lot of odd thought experiments. Like, for example, if you believe in absolute property rights, you would be completely fine with someone buying St. Paul's Cathedral and then turning it into apartment blocks or something like that.
Sure.
And as a conservative, one of the differences between conservatism and classical liberalism is that conservatives tend to see rights, in the natural rights sense, as subservient to higher ends. And one of the ends that you would consider it subservient to is culture. So I don't think that someone's property rights should be able to, say, buy a grade 2 listed building and then demolish it. I don't think you should be able to use your individuality to destroy the culture of a nation. Mm. One of the main reasons why that's important, not just because things like art and music and language are important in themselves and lead people to have fulfilling lives, is because the conditions under which people can have a free society don't just pop up because everyone sits together in a room and signs a contract called the social contract and then decides to have all these rights.
Which we never signed.
Yes, precisely. So the actual way that people form a society is because they already have a shared sense of belonging, and then the law and their constitution and whatever else they legislate is just reiterating how they already feel about each other, which is that we have a shared sense of belonging, we want to work together, these are the rights we're going to have to do this. One of the guys that influenced me a lot, he's a modern conservative thinker, his name is Roger Scruton. I'm not sure if you've heard of him.
I have, yes.
Yeah, so he writes about something called a first-person plural, which I think is a really nice phrase. It's the idea that before you make, in inverted commas, a nation, you all get together and you already have a shared sense of belonging. You use the word we. You no longer say the word I and myself. You say, we, ourselves. You can refer to what your community is doing and know that there's a general understanding. And so I think one of the most important things today for conservatism, especially in an era of multiculturalism, when they'd have you believe that a world where nations are filled with people with as little in common as possible, we're supposed to be more free and more happy. You have to ask yourself, what is it that makes a nation cohesive and work together? And I think it's a shared sense of belonging. It's speaking the same language. It's understanding the same values. It's being able to reference the same heroes in your history and the same novels and your stories. You know, you mentioned Harry Potter. Everyone in the UK knows who Harry Potter is. And if I wanted to be cringy, I could make a Harry Potter analogy and everyone would understand that I was referring to something as part of the collective belonging of people in the United Kingdom. Yes. Yeah, so that's for me the main difference between conservatism and classical liberalism. Classical liberalism is promoting freedom, and conservatives are suspicious of how much freedom you can give people before society starts to bear, you know, before it starts to strain society.
Okay, fair enough. So do you think, I mean, the conservative project to me seems to have changed over the years. And just because there has been some movement, if I look at American conservatives, for example, the Republicans have generally a conservative party. They represent the conservatives in the United States. I think that would be a fair comment. Some people would argue that now with Trump in at the head of the party, basically. But there has been some movement on certain things. Social issues seems to be the big one. So whether it's a view that the battle's been lost on something like gay marriage, for example, which conservatives 30, 40 years ago would have been the people against gay marriage. And now it's difficult to find people arguing too much against that position, maybe just because of the way it is. And it's kind of a norm now. Do you think conservatism's been through a change, or is going through a change, or needs to find itself again?
Yeah, big time. I'm not sure if you can hear that massive noise. Someone's decided to start drilling next to me.
Oh, is it drilling?
I apologize for that.
No,
really
problem.
Convenient.
Yeah, it's a real life podcast, so no problem.
Yeah, well, that's London for you. Everyone's always digging up half the city. Anyway, I mean, conservatism in the UK has always meant something very different to conservatism in the United States. You know, there was a war of independence for a start. So what the US is trying to conserve was totally against what the UK was trying to conserve. The US had this, you know, idea of a constitution that would have been considered extremely liberal at the time, because you know, you're breaking away from a state that's been controlling you. You want lower taxes, you want more freedom in terms of economics, in terms of religious freedom. So conservatism in the States is very different. It's much closer to classical liberalism than the conservatism that I was talking about earlier, or at least that's what it's been taken to mean. I'm not sure whether the founding fathers thought about hostile religions, for example, being cultivated within their borders, but that's that. In the UK, conservatism has been taken to mean basically economically liberal and socially liberal as well. And I don't speak to anyone my age, to be honest, apart from a few friends who I always have political chats with. I don't speak to anyone that even understands that there could be an idea of conservatism or supporting the Tory party and then being socially conservative.
Yes.
It just doesn't occur to them. All that the Conservative Party is about for the majority of people, I think, in the UK, what they think of when they're not always thinking about politics is, for people on the right, is you should be allowed to keep more of your own money and that will incentivize wealth creation. And for people on the left, it's you stand for all the rich bastards in the FTSE 500 and you clearly hate the coal miners. I think that's probably the image that we have. But no one ever talks about social issues.
Well, you do often hear people say, I'm economically conservative and socially liberal. That's a relatively common refrain.
Yes.
Which I suppose in the current day would mean something to the effect of, I like low taxes, I like a relatively smaller government, but whatever you want to do in your bedroom is not my issue, and I don't really care what religion you practice, et cetera, those sort of issues. You do care more about those things?
I'm not sure whether I care more about them, because it's no good debating about whether we should be teaching our children the culture of our country when the economy is falling apart and people are starving to death. So the economy is very important too. But I think that the economy isn't necessarily what makes life worth living. So, I mean, if you live in a country where you're extremely prosperous. So, outside of university, I live in Dubai, and I've lived there for about a year and a half now. And that is just a hellhole of materialism. The only places to go. I mean, you just see endless Arabs wearing the traditional attire, wearing, you know, driving Mercedes G-classes, and they'll turn up at the shopping mall, which is like the fourth shopping mall within a 10-mile radius. And that's all you can do for the whole day because there's literally nothing to do. I mean, if you like modern architecture, it's interesting, which I don't. I despise it. So the only place that I like really is seeing the traditional Islamic architecture, which I find personally interesting because it's all based on geometry. In Islam, you're not allowed to depict it's frowned upon to depict human beings.
Forms, yeah.
Yeah, so their art is always based on mathematical equations and patterns, and so it's quite interesting to see a completely different style of architecture. But that's all I can do in Dubai. And I asked myself, well, look, you might be really prosperous. You might be creating great conditions to go clubbing and go shopping. But do I want my kids to grow up here? There's nothing exciting about it. There's not even adherence to the religion very much amongst the population. There's no literature, there's no art. The museums that I go to, they're in Abu Dhabi. So I ask myself, what do I want in my country? And economics is like, it's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient for having a really beautiful place to live, in my opinion.
It's interesting because, you know, we have higher rates of mental illness now than we've ever had in history.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we haven't been keeping those statistics very long, but certainly we're more prosperous than we've ever been. For example, a middle-class person in the United States, or in Britain for that matter, lives better today than, in fact, even the lower class lives better today than someone from the upper class did 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
In terms of the progress we've made, just simple things, refrigeration, for example.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, domestic appliances, if you think about how much, I mean, literally half of the population, women, would have been essentially enslaved into household serfdom, having the amount of labor they had to do.
Yes.
And the refrigerator and microwaves and washing machines, this is just freed up. So economics can really do good things for people.
Sure. And so we're more prosperous than we've ever been, certainly in the West. And I would argue some places that aren't necessarily the West, but have certainly adopted some of what the success the West has had. But there doesn't seem to be as much happiness and as much prosperity. And it's interesting. When I mean prosperity, I mean more in a, not in a wealth sense. I mean it more in a sort of well-being sense.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's not linked to finding happiness within sort of cultural things, as you're referring to, and whether we've dispensed with those too easily. I suppose that would be the central thrust of modern conservatism, that we need to sort of find those things and preserve them where they exist.
Yeah, I read a book recently on exactly that. It's one of these little, almost pamphlet books, I think only 100 pages. It's called Tribe, by a journalist called Sebastian Junger, if I remember correctly. And this guy, he paints this story of when he went hitchhiking when he was a kid, and then he goes to the siege of Sarajevo, and he goes to different war zones, and he's basically talking about why is it that in largely peaceful Western societies, people feel this sense of nihilism, of not belonging to anything, whereas in war zones, people actually report being happier than people who are living in apartments in Western cities. And he talks about how he thinks this is because people lack a sense of belonging. And when you have times of struggle, people are forced to come together. And all of those evolutionary circuits which human beings are designed to have to make us feel good about cooperating and enjoying each other's presence, they get fired up again. So our existence is almost too peaceful and too nice to drive people together. But the interesting thing about that book is that he has a very left-wing view on it, I think, actually. He takes almost this Rousseauian idea that society's corrupted the individual instead of being something that's clearly been progress. I mean, we don't die of tuberculosis at the age of 26 anymore. Mm-hmm. And then he does this bizarre thing where he goes on to... So from his conclusion that we need to feel a sense of belonging in order to be happy, his conclusion is that classic left-wing cosmopolitan conclusion, which is that to make us as much, to make us as happy as possible, let's just extend belonging to the entire world. We'll all be part of one race, the human race, no matter what your values are, no matter whether you believe in certain things that people have fought and died to protect.
That all cultures are equal.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll all be, sunshine and rainbows forever,
yeah,
because no one will ever feel any sense of being apart from anyone else. And I just completely disagree with that. I mean, for a start, I don't want to belong to certain cultures and certain religions and whatnot. I have no desire. In fact, I'd vehemently oppose it. And if they started trying to push for these things in my country big time, then you'd have to... I don't think the democratic process would be enough for me to register my resistance to it.
You know,
so I don't want, you know, go on.
No, no, sure. I think a lot of this is also based in, I was listening to something the other day, this notion of people being inherently good. And many people believe that most people are good people. And evil... It takes a lot for evil to thrive, actually, and that's completely untrue. People are capable of good. People are capable of evil, and actually, yeah, you need very little evil for evil to thrive. So you can attend a school for 10 years, and everyone there is good, except for one guy who decides to wake up in the morning and bring a gun and start shooting people. That's only one evil person amongst hundreds or thousands, and then evil has shown its head. This idea, and I feel like this plays a lot into this. You referred to multiculturalism and that sort of view. That plays a lot into this. Everyone ultimately is good, and they just want to live their lives, and they don't want to bother their neighbors. And that's not true. Some people do want to bother their neighbors, and some people have bad ideas, and some people's cultures are bad. Like, they're just bad. Like, they seek to dominate. They seek to enslave or murder. And we seem to have lost the ability to differentiate what is good from what is bad because of this belief that everything ultimately can be good.
I think it stems from, I think the reason why a lot of people want to subscribe to that idea is because they see themselves as fighting the global forces of oppression, whatever that means. You know, they'll go out and they'll get fired up about colonialism because a university professor or Huffington Post said something on their Facebook feed or whatever. They'll get fired up. They'll start believing that there's this global conspiracy against anyone who isn't an old white man. And then, of course, the people who they're trying to protect often have values that not only harm those people because they're screwing over their own countries and their own ability to succeed, but they're also screwing over anyone else who those values touch. And so the people who are, you know, fighting oppression have this dilemma here. They've got to decide between either admitting that some cultures are better than others and some values are better than others, in which case they've got to criticize the people they're claiming to protect, or they can just deny that there's any sense of good or bad. They can, you know, support these ideas of moral relativism where, you know, you tell someone that there's this tribe that sacrifices children and they'll go, well, it's just their culture, you know, it's beautiful diversity. We should probably do it in London or something like that. And so I think that there's so many contradictions with this idea that you've got to protect all of the oppressed people across the world from, you know, this evil, nasty Illuminati of white guys.
Yeah.
And then you trip over yourself trying to basically say that everyone else is perfect and everything that's wrong in the world is because of a bunch of Christians or something.
There's also quite poor reasoning. Often things like that, you find, say, this tribe that murders children. And the excuse isn't just, oh, well, it's their culture, but it often comes along with a false equivalent, such as, oh, well, America bombs children. So that's the same thing. Or something like that. So there's a lot of weak thinking around some of these ideas, and let's get to the weakest sort of thinking that happens on a global scale, which is called socialism, in my opinion. And of course, we can keep it's the socialism communism spectrum. The way I view it, really, is that they're not different things. And if you understand what Marx wrote, and you go back and read. Socialism was the beginning of a pathway to communism. Ultimately, you cannot have. You have to have a rising up against the bourgeoisie of the working class. They topple the bourgeoisie. They take control of the means of production. And then through a process of redistribution, you ultimately end up where everyone is exactly equal, i.e. communism.
Yeah.
So if you're socialist, you really are communist. You're just sort of a soft communist, so to speak. And you know, if you admit that you're just communist, then fine. Let's get into a little bit of your dislike for socialism, and obviously we've got it rearing its head in South Africa with you know, the government wanting to take back property, abolish property rights, really nationalize everything they can get their hands on, even though they've proven that everything that is currently nationalized, our airline, for example, is pretty much a complete mess.
I mean, the problem... So I'll talk about a few economic problems with socialism, because I find it so interesting that so many people can make such big mistakes. And then I'll talk about something that is... that is, I think, the reason why these mistakes are made, the main reason why. So let's take the example of the expropriation of land. The problem with collective land ownership, I mean, you see this in the United States where the federal government owns land, is that no one in particular is responsible for it. So in China, after Mao's land reforms and you know, Mao started changing the economy around, I think it was in the 80s, that this bunch of farmers working on this farm, and of course, because it was all, it's all about communism, it's all about the totality of everyone being equal, they had to share the farmland. And what the farmers did, and if they'd have been found out, they would have been executed, was that they divided up this piece of land into four or five plots, you know, depending on the number of farmers there was. And instead of all four or five farmers looking after all of the land together, they each looked after their own piece of land. And what that means is that when you work hard, you receive 100% of the benefits. Whereas if you're in a pool of people and you work hard, so you put in 100% more effort, you'll only get 10% out. So the idea of collective ownership is exactly against the idea that you should basically take risks and then you should get the rewards for it, because it incentivizes you doing new things. So these Chinese farmers, they something like quadrupled the output of their farm just by dividing up the exact same amount of resources, but more effectively, and privatizing the gains that you get from working harder. So when you go on.
And their model spread, from what my understanding of the story, I think it was in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, but their model actually spread to multiple villages to the point that the output was so great that the government, it caused reform, essentially. And it caused the Chinese government not to do anything about it, essentially. They let this happen because it was improving the production.
Exactly. I'm doing an internship at the moment at an economics think tank here in Westminster in the UK. And one of the funny things that they told us yesterday was that, so you've got these, I think it's, you've got Mao, and he basically wants to make the Chinese economy better. So he gets in a room a bunch of the best technocrats and a bunch of the best Marxist theoreticians. And he gets the technocrats to decide what's good for the economy. And then he gets the Marxist theoreticians to define whatever the technocrats say as Marxist. So China's got this interesting thing where, you know, they've still got this whole Communist Party and whatnot, but there's a lot of, they've only succeeded because they've tempered it with capitalism, which is hilarious. But so anyway, the main problem with socialism is that it disincentivizes more efficient production, because you're not giving anyone a reason to work harder. If you're one of 1,000 people who collectively owns a farm and you work literally twice as long, you're going to get no more fruit or meat than anyone else, because your input is going to be a drop in an ocean. So you'll never work harder. And so people just, the economy falls apart. So that's the first problem. The second problem is I think the even greater one. And this is a really interesting thing from a conservative and classical liberal perspective. It's the idea of spontaneous order. It's the idea that just because of incentives, you don't need to have someone planning the economy. You can just leave people to do their own thing. And as if by magic, just like an ecosystem which arises, and you know, it doesn't need someone telling which plants to grow where and which insects to eat which plants. It just happens over time. And very quickly, you get a really brilliant, efficient system. I think it was Gorbachev, went to the United States in the 80s, and he saw a supermarket. And he said, my God, who is planning this supermarket? Brilliant. And of course, the miraculous thing, and I can't get my head around this, I still can't. It just seems like magic. It's just pure capitalist magic, and it really pisses off lefties, is the idea that if you leave people to their own devices, they don't just cause chaos and then a bunch of capitalists take over and start exploiting them. They create systems where no one in particular knows how it works, controls how it works, but it works beautifully and it adapts continuously and it creates prosperity. So spontaneous order, the idea that you actually, someone planning stuff actually makes it worse. This is what Hayek called the fatal conceit of government. The idea that a bunch of guys in a room think they know better how to run the economy and what people want than millions upon millions of consumers. So the two problems of socialism are it wrecks the incentives to be good at stuff, and usually the people who you put in charge of making things good are awful at it compared to just the average person in the street.
Yeah, and I think both of those things speak to bigger concepts. One is sort of the human condition and human nature, which is, you know, the left goes to great lengths these days to convince us that we are all equal, or we should be striving to all be to equality. So the right says, look, we should all have equal rights, and those generally most of us believe in negative rights, not positive rights. So yes. The thing that just for those listening that don't know the difference, negative rights don't require the work of anyone else or anyone else's effort, essentially, to exist. So freedom doesn't require anyone else's effort. People just need to leave you alone. Whereas something like healthcare is a positive right, because if you make healthcare a right, well, then a doctor and a nurse and whatever are obliged to provide you with a service. And if you're in a country which can't afford that service, then the doctor and the nurse must be a slave. There's this push towards this idea of equality. Everyone's the same, and factually we're not. One of the ones that is quite popular at the moment is obviously men and women are identical. There is no functional difference in any way between men and women. And so we get into these weird sort of gender fluid arguments and these 72 genders on Facebook and all these kinds of sports debates, because we are trying to deny that men, for example, are physically stronger than women, a fact, just as it is, or that women are better at nurturing than men are on average, because we don't want to admit that, you know, women might be better at parenting or whatever it is, in a certain sense. So there's this push towards equality, this denial of human nature and what humans are and how we function. I think that speaks to the first part. Certainly not everyone, if we were all farmers tomorrow, some of us would be really good at it and some of us would be really crap at it. Just as right now, there are people doing the job any of us are doing, and some are much better at it than others, and some are really terrible at it. And hopefully the terrible ones will find something else to do. So that's the one side that you've spoken about. And the other side is obviously speaks towards just freedom in general and liberty. And that's obviously an ongoing fight with those who want others to control them, you know, the clever men in a room who can all decide for us how our lives should be lived, and they know better. They know better for us. And it's interesting, because how do you feel statism falls both on the left and the right?
How do I feel it falls?
Yeah, so I mean, the right has used statism to enforce their goals, and so has the left. The left has I don't think even arguably, I think the left has factually been number one better at it, but at the same time worse.
So they just admit they want it.
Well, that's one, and secondly, when the left gets control, as you know, Mao, Pol Pot, Stalin, Lenin, they kill hundreds of millions of people. They're far better at being quite vicious to get to their end point. But there's a danger, I think. You know, I'm very wary of the government, of all governments. I really just want them to kind of get out of the way. And there's a real danger of both sides using the government to enforce their endpoints.
Yeah, there is. And the interesting thing about classical liberalism, and really any philosophy that respects human freedom, is that you'll have people on the right wanting the government to do one thing, and you'll have people on the left wanting the government to do another thing. Mm. And in between, there's a tiny group of mentally sane people saying, can the government just not do anything, please? Which is fascinating. I mean, I'm surprised it's not a more popular idea, for God's sake.
Yeah, look, I think where the balance comes in, it's a pity Ramon's not here today, actually, because Ramon is an anarchist. He says he's pragmatic, so he kind of gets that, you know, we're not there just yet, and we might never get there, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but essentially he would prefer an anarchy. He would prefer a state of no state whatsoever, just social contracts, actual discussed and agreed upon social contracts between individuals.
Right.
You know, he kind of likes that view. I understand the government's role in certain aspects, but it's interesting how little people are able to move away from government being able to do things. And I think I kind of get it to some extent. You know, often people tease libertarians about Mo Rhodes, you know, because it'll be that's one of the weaker arguments about libertarians is why does the government need to do the roads? You know, we can do the roads ourselves. But I think the average person goes, I actually have no interest in knowing how the road happens. Like, I don't care how it gets planned. I don't care who tars it. I just want to drive on it. So I think a lot of people look at it and go, well, if the government's just going to make the road happen, then fine, the government can exist for that purpose. And then they multiply that by many, many things. And
this is the problem.
And I suppose it's a slippery slope in some respects, because it starts off with the roads, for example. And then when you get to the point like in the UK where you have the NHS and we have our government trying to introduce something quite similar here called the NHI. The difference is we have a much smaller GDP and only about 10% of our entire population pays tax. So if you think the NHS has problems, you can only imagine what that's going to do to healthcare in this country. But there's this dependence that gets created as we sort of say, well, the government will take care of that. I'm not really interested in sorting it out for myself.
Yes. I think it's also because it's just by virtue of who is asking the questions and how they ask them. So it'll often be people, suppose you've got a bunch of academics sitting down and they're talking about, the economy. If you read the Western canon of political philosophy, starting at Plato, and I hate that bastard.
Aristotle fan, are you?
I love Aristotle.
Yeah,
Plato,
he's great.
Plato and Aristotle, their duel, I think, is just present all throughout history. But Plato, you know, the way Plato solves his problems about society is he just sits down and just asks, how should society be? Oh, I'll just plan every single little detail, including how educated the leaders are.
The original central planner.
Yeah, exactly. And then he goes off and so he sits down in his room, decides what he wants everything to look like, and then there's just this assumption going on that someone, because he's a big brain Wojak, is going to employ all of this for him. So when people sit down and they think they're having an educated discussion about how to solve problems in the economy, there's always this implicit notion that after they've decided, they'll just hand this piece of paper to someone and he'll go off, send everyone who doesn't agree to prison or something like that, and then go and employ it. And so for me, I think it's the style in which we ask political questions actually implies certain solutions over other ones. And it means that we all have this conception of, well, the government should solve it first. And it took me a while to get out of that thinking. It takes most people, I think, to ever get out of that thinking.
I think even children, you know, as children, we kind of raised a lot of, you start seeing a lot of this stuff, when you're around kids, you know, in parenting and all the rest of it, and you start seeing sort of these ideas which sort of work at a child level, but they really don't work at an adult level. Like sharing is caring is a great example. I mean, that is ultimate sort of socialist redistributive motto. And perhaps it's good for kids to learn to share amongst each other. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, when it gets applied not between brother and sister or two kids who are friends or whatever it is, and it must be applied across a whole society, that's when you start hitting problems. And I the government is a similar idea, because this government is this sort of ethereal thing, especially when you're a kid and a teenager. You kind of don't connect the government as being just average people who got sort of hopefully voted into positions and do things. And some of the things they do are right and some of the things they do are wrong. You kind of just assume, oh, the government, it's got this official sort of seal and stamp. And so if the government does it, it must be right.
It's like a big parent, isn't it, for all of the kids that never really quite grew up.
Well, absolutely. And this is what's happened is we've made the government into our parents. The government must provide us with our health care. If we need food, the government must do that. The government must look after all of our needs instead of trying to be self-sufficient in many respects.
Yeah, and what people don't realize, this always gets me, the idea that the government should pay for something. The government doesn't have any money. It has no money whatsoever. It's not a profit-making organization. It's taxpayers' money. So when you say the government should pay for something, what you mean is your kids are going to pay for it because it'll put you in national debt big time. Or you mean the 1% in inverted commas will pay for it, which will either do what it did in France when they put the income tax up to, you know, top tier up to something like, something ridiculous.
90%,
like 80%
something ridiculous.
And it'll send them all abroad, or it'll disincentivize it, or it will mean that you've got a government planning how to spend that money instead of entrepreneurs. I mean, who do you think is going to be better at spending money and creating wealth in the economy? Someone like Steve Jobs, who grew his business from a garage and made one of the most powerful computer companies on the planet, or some git who went and studied, I don't know, policymaking at a university and then decided that he now knows more than the greatest entrepreneurs to ever have lived. It's absurd. I hate it. It just pisses me off. Now I'm pissed off about economics. Here we go. You've done it. You've enraged.
It's fine. You can read some Hayek to soothe yourself. So, yeah, I think that's a perfect point. Just around who pays for things. And as I've said, we've brought this up on the podcast many times before, but the government, as you correctly point out very succinctly, is the government doesn't have any money. They have your money, or they have your future money. We see governments, many governments, being in massive amounts of debt. That massive amount of debt is to pay for your inverted commas free healthcare, or your inverted commas free schooling or free tertiary education or whatever. There's no such thing as free. This idea of free as well is quite interesting in the sense of people feel that if there's nothing leaving their wallet or their bank account, then it's naturally must be free. It just gets sort of produced without realizing the potential damage down the line.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever come across Henry Hazlitt's Economics and
One Lesson. Yes, great book.
Yeah, I mean, I've studied economics for 4 years now, and I think that and Ha-Joon Chang, I think, are two of the guys. If you've not studied economics before, you should definitely read, because they're just brilliant. So that's a recommendation to your listeners. But one of the things he points out is interesting is that you have to ask yourself what's going on for all groups at all times with this policy that I'm employing. Don't just look at the immediate consequences. And when you talk about healthcare, say. So what people will have you believe is that you'll increase taxes just a little bit for everyone, and then you'll all get this magical free healthcare. But what you're forgetting is that if each person is taxed, say, £5 a month extra, that's £5 a month they're not spending in a shop, and then the shopkeeper would spend at the petrol station, and the guy who works at the petrol station till will then spend out for dinner with his wife or something. So you have to ask yourself, even the tiniest bit of money that you're taking away to create this new magical lump of thing, healthcare, for example, is actually having a huge impact on the economy when you do it with everybody. Mm. And that's something that I don't think the left can get their head around. I mean, we were talking about national debt as well. And one of the things, this is another like classic contradiction that I've tried to understand, and I just do not, with classic lefty thinking, is this idea about sustainability. So you'll always hear the left, you know, certain lefties, environmental lefties, not that there's anything wrong with wanting to protect the environment, it's a noble cause, I think, banging on about how we need to be more sustainable. We need to use this and that material. We need to ban this and that. We need to make sure that we're not destroying the environment. But then when they think about getting their kids and their grandkids and their great-grandkids into irretrievably high levels of debt that they will never be able to pay off, that to them is fine. It doesn't ring the sustainability alarm bell. So, you know, look after the environment for your generation because it makes you feel good about having some fucking dolphin skin bag because, I don't know, Lush sold it or something. Yeah. But if you're talking about sustainability in terms of economic terms, in terms of whether you're living according to your means, it just does not occur to them. And I can't grasp why they don't make that connection. It's so obvious.
And in fact, I don't know what the UK numbers are. South Africa's already basically bankrupt. Our debt to GDP ratio, I think, is 60% at the moment, or getting close. But the US, if I remember, I might get the order wrong, but in 2026, I think it is, Medicare is going to go bankrupt. And in 2032, I think it is, their entire social service system will go bankrupt. So one of two things is going to happen. They'll have to tell pensioners, you don't get, in 2032, you don't get anything anymore. Thanks for putting that money all away those years, but we've spent it. Or they'll just have to refinance, which is what governments seem to think is a solution. I suppose if you're only in office for 4 or 8 years or 10 years, then maybe that is a solution, because by the time the bill comes around to pay, it won't be your problem. But there is a real misunderstanding of the unsustainable nature in which these things are held. And even when people point to, one of my frustrations on social media is people saying things like, I'm a social democrat, not like Venezuela, actually like Denmark. That drives me insane, because there's a complete misunderstanding of the fundamental, firstly, functions of a country like Denmark, or Norway, or any of those countries, whereby the government is actually has a very free market. So the government has not interfered with the free market. But what they have done is they have built tax their populace to almost death. Somewhere like Denmark, you pay close to 80% of everything you earn goes to the government.
I think it's Sweden is 60% or something.
Just to put that in context, if you work for 12 months of the year, you are working and earning nothing for 10 months of it. You get things in return, inverted commas, things in return. If you get sick, you will get treated at healthcare. If you never get sick, then you're working for nothing. And if your neighbor gets sick, you're paying for him. You're literally working for your neighbor. So if that suits you. But the other thing they forget is that those countries have, for example, large oil reserves,
that they don't. Their defense spending, I mean, they Scandinavia, for example, borders Russia. So you would expect,
heavy defense
spending. But it's, I mean, for want of a better phrase, it's massively subsidized by the United States.
Mm.
So if it wasn't the case that the US was actually doing big parts of the economy for the Scandinavians, they'd have a much, much higher tax bill and their system wouldn't work. There's a good paper that the think tank that I'm working at has produced called Scandinavian Unexceptionalism. And it basically debunks this paradise utopia belief that a lot of lefties have when they point north and say, well, look at these countries. They're all doing fine.
Yeah, they work beautifully.
You know, I mean, and by the way, these countries are extremely homogeneous. They're extremely, until recently at least, suspicious of anything to do with multiculturalism. They are, of course, Christian countries. They've inherited that tradition. They're no longer pagan and whatnot else. So. Again, it's another case of lefties not seeing any further than they want to see. But, yeah. I mean, by the end of this podcast, I really don't think we should be surprised by that anymore, but it'll perpetually annoy me.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised by it, but it's unbelievable the volume of evidence against those beliefs and those views and those ways of doing things in the world. And yet, you know, I'm sitting in a country right now which is literally following the exact same path of Venezuela, of Zimbabwe, of Cuba, of communist China, of communist Russia. In fact, the policies that are informing all of this literally, quite literally, come from the Russians, from the Communist Party. So it's quite astonishing that, given all the evidence and all the sort of test cases over history and over again, that we still seem to need to have this argument. And perhaps the psychology is a more interesting discussion around why this has to be repeated.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a theory about that.
But, go for it.
Before I mention it, it's just the, you know, you sometimes hear these young kids say, you know, well, Marxism is nice in theory, but it doesn't work in practice.
Hmm.
And I just wondered to myself, did you read Das Kapital? It's shit in theory. It's awful. He literally gets every single fucking thing you could possibly get wrong with economics. He gets wrong. He gets immediately wrong his idea about how goods and services are valued in an economy.
Because yes.
He has a labor theory
labor.
Of value,
yep.
which is wrong.
Yep.
He distinguishes, I think erroneously, between use value and exchange value. The idea that a good is useful in, and that determines one price, if you like, but exchangeable in another way, and that determines another price. When, of course, use value and exchange value are entirely related. So you just go step by step through the book, and every single thing that he says, with very few exceptions, you can just like scream at him and say, "But did you read the other economists around your time?" So for these bloody lefty kids, I mean, they don't. Okay, I appreciate it. Not everyone has the time in the world to study economics. But everyone has the time in the world to consult common sense. And if you want to talk to someone for 5 minutes and take out an economics textbook, and by the way, it wasn't written as a conspiracy to keep capitalists on top. It was written because 300 years of theorizing and thinking about why human beings do things they do has led us to these conclusions. Like, just the very basics of supply and demand is enough to start questioning this bullshit.
Absolutely.
It's weird. But the thing that... this is the fallacy that I think... drives socialism and drives this constant, perpetual belief that left-wing stuff, redistribution is the right idea. So you mentioned about when we're children and we see our parents as a kind of government and then everything's solved by the parents and then that attitude transfers over. And I was just wondering to myself about, when you have a pizza and you've got your friends, if I take one more slice of pizza, it necessarily means that one of my mates takes less pizza. So taking slices of pizza is what you call in game theory a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
And the left-wing conception of the economy, it is that distribution of wealth and income is zero-sum. That is, if I've got a big house, that means that someone else out there must have a small house. If I've got lots of healthcare, it must mean that someone else has got no healthcare.
Yeah.
But of course... free trade is not zero sum. This is again like the basics of economics. So if there's two people, let's say Joe and Jill, and Joe's got a pie and Jill's got 50 quid, and they exchange this. The reason they do that is because Joe is better off with 50 quid than he was with the pie, and Jill is better off with the pie than she was with 50 quid. So all trade, and the proof of it is that it happens. Otherwise, people wouldn't do it. Is positive sum. The economy is a positive sum game. When people have free trade, when people can unlock their talents and their hard work
and potential,
you end up with a bigger pizza, as it were. But the left wing conception of the economy is that the amount of stuff you have is fixed, and that means that in order to get a fairer society, there's no point incentivizing wealth creation. There's no point incentivizing creating a bigger pizza. You should just reallocate the pizza, and that's the main problem. It's something that is always it's referred to as zero. Zero something.
And as more of your friends come to the party, what then happens is everyone gets a smaller and smaller pizza, unfortunately, to
precisely.
The point that you're just eating crumbs.
Exactly. Until someone turns around and says, hold on a moment, maybe we should bake another one. And then you get the miracle of capitalism because someone's really good at making pizza and they go and do it. I just love capitalism.
We have a good example of exactly what you've just said in South Africa and unlocking potential and it not being a zero-sum game. So our government built these things called RDP houses. So a lot of the population, obviously, after 1994 was living in shacks and still are, for that matter. But one of the successes of our government is that they have built somewhere in the region of 12 million houses, I think it is. But these they're not particularly good houses. They're very small, and there's a lot of quality problems in terms of who they got to build them, because, of course, it's the government. But anyway, they built these houses on these plots. The problem is that the people who live in these houses do not own the houses. So they get given the keys, but they don't get given the title deeds. And there's long been an argument of our think tanks here and our civil action groups, certainly on the right, that people should be given title deeds to their properties. And the argument always from the left is, oh, but if you give them title deeds, they'll just sell the houses and then be homeless. I'm not realizing that, for example, if someone wants to sell their house, firstly, that's their decision, and they'll make a plan for where they live. And if they want to leverage that house, for example, you can't even leverage the house at the bank for a loan because you don't have a title deed. So right. You can't send your kid to university against a leveraged asset because you don't have a leveraged asset. And this is, I think, a really good example of an area in which we've been practicing a zero-sum game in this country on housing, for example.
That's interesting. It's interesting that they don't let people sell their houses because otherwise people would.
No,
the houses.
Government owns them. I mean, the government. Yeah. So those houses are still government owned.
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, amongst the other things that Margaret Thatcher did that were very good, there was a big push towards this phrase property owning democracy, and the idea that people should have a house, they should have something to take out loans against to unlock further prosperity. And whatnot. But the interesting thing about not letting people sell houses and not letting them own them is if they want to sell a house, unless they're drastically misinformed, it's because that selling the house is good for them and their family.
Yes.
Maybe they want to downsize. Maybe they want to move somewhere else. Maybe they want to go and live in a much smaller house but send their child to university.
Mm-hmm. And so, or there's an opportunity cost to make more money. The thing about wealth creation is that people don't understand that wealth creation is done through risk. It's never done without risk. And so,
precisely.
And so you know, at that level, it might be leveraging your house or selling your house so that your kid can go to university, so that 4 years later, your family income quadruples overnight. Things like that.
I mean, again, it's just a case of people sitting in power, thinking that because they've earned their degree from a university where everyone thinks the same as them, that they have now earned the right to decide and to know what millions of other people actually want to do with their own lives. There is no way that someone sitting in the head office in the South Africa's whatever housing commission or something knows what millions of families want and whether they want to live in those houses or other houses. There's no way that they could ever survey that, calculate it, anything.
Yeah.
But they're unwilling to let people decide for themselves. It's bizarre. Really bizarre.
Yeah, some of it's bizarre and some of it's just sort of Orwellian stuff. You know, the expropriation, for example, is this idea that every black person in this country wants some piece of land, bearing in mind that our population has been moving into cities like every other population on the planet for the past 20 years. And nobody really wants to be in rural areas and nobody really wants to be a farmer on average. Of course, there are a few people who do want to be farmers and are farmers, and that we're very grateful for those people. But the government, the current sort of selling point is, the land must be returned to the people.
Yeah.
God knows what they're going to do with it, because a piece of land 400 kilometers from the center of Johannesburg is going to be completely useless to someone who has a job in Johannesburg.
Precisely. And the government's probably thinking about this in terms of how useful land was, say, 50 years ago, because that's the era people would have studied. That's the era when people would have been really upset about the distribution of resources between whites and blacks in South Africa. I forget where I was reading it, but the interesting thing about socialist economies is for a very brief time, they do okay. For a very, very brief time. But what happens is that just like a cloud of smoke, you know, it starts off quite orderly. I always watch people smoking cigarettes and I find it fascinating because you see the smoke for maybe about 10 inches. It rises in completely orderly fashion. And then all of a sudden, the physics
takes sort over of
and
wind.
It spreads out in chaos. Mm. And so you get this immediate emergence of chaos very, very quickly, almost exponentially. And so that's exactly what the economy is like, because you'll have a short period of time when the government can plan everything and they might have got things right. But then as certain conditions change, for example, as the demographics in South Africa change and people want to move to cities, the government didn't take that into account when they made their plan of how the economy is going to work. They planned it for how conditions were at the time. They can never account for all of these unseen things that are going to happen in the future, like people moving to cities. So they're basing their calculations of land allocation on the usefulness of land 50 years ago. Not on the usefulness of land today, when people want to move to the city and get, you know, intellectual jobs, service-based jobs. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just one more case.
Yeah,
I think of the government getting stuff wrong.
I think that's a fair assessment. I think we, on top of that, have a nefarious. There's other nefarious sort of motives we have amongst our government, and
basically,
just theft of the state. Because obviously, socialism always leads to actually the 1%.
I saw a very interesting
the true 1% is in a socialist state.
Precisely. I mean, in a free market, the 1% are just economically you know, inverted commas, powerful. In a socialist place, the 1% are politically powerful. So there's not even like they need to lobby the government. They are the government. Mm-hmm. I went to Kiev earlier this summer, and, you know, this wonderful socialist paradise, there's this ginormous statue of this Mother Russia kind of figure looking towards Moscow with a huge shield with the hammer and sickle.
I've actually seen a photo. It's quite, you know, impressive, that statue.
The locals call her Tintis. It's hilarious. So there's your Soviet ideals compared to your Ukrainian reality. But the fascinating thing is that, you know, amongst this city where, you know, they're working towards a wonderfully equal society, I want to know why they built these shacks, these 12, 13-story shacks for the average Ukrainian to live in. But then once you move towards the center of the town, you see these ornate communist apartment blocks with obviously mass-produced but at least somewhat attractive embroidery in the brickwork and everything like that. If they really were building a classless, egalitarian society, why is it the case that they built buildings, knowing that buildings last hundreds of years, and they built some fantastically for the leaders and some like dog shit for the average Ukrainian? It's clearly because the people at the top are going to use their power to benefit themselves. That's human nature. And the fascinating thing about this is in this Orwell book that I was reading the other day. The fascinating thing about totalitarian regimes of the 20th century compared to previous despotisms is that the 20th century, because it didn't have this backdrop of Christianity and this backdrop of questioning human nature, the 20th century forgot the lessons that we've learned about human nature being fundamentally, you know, not up to scratch and being broken, and it instead conceived of people as perfect. Yep. And so, if for totalitarian thinkers and governments, it never occurred to them to plan against people using power badly. You see this all the way back in Rousseau. Rousseau has this idea of the general will, of the idea that once you stop the elite from controlling society and you let the masses control it through, I guess what you could call democracy, then nothing will ever go wrong because people would never possibly hurt themselves. When we know that, people do hurt themselves and they hurt other people, and that's what they do when you put them in power. And that's the whole point of having a constitution and having, you know, splitting up the different functions of government.
And because they're not the same, and people have different wants and needs, and what I want might hurt you and what you want might hurt me. And
precisely.
And so given the power, I might be very dangerous.
Yeah, and so you have to create a system where you acknowledge that people have different wants and needs, and you use that for good rather than trying to suppress it for evil, which is always going to be an uphill losing battle. And that system is freedom and spontaneous order and allowing people to do their own thing. As long as you have the rule of law, you'll find that people who want to get rich, the only way they can do that is by benefiting the economy. Whereas when you have a weak rule of law and it can be corrupted, people can get rich just by going into government. Yeah, I think, what was it we were, I think we were talking about at this think tank as well, one of the fastest ways to get rich is to become president of Mexico. Because, you know, they all make like the Forbes 100 list or whatever.
Yes.
Why is it the case that if you become president, you're supposed to be serving your country, you end up massively rich? And that is the government. That is definitely a zero-sum game. You've definitely got that money from someone else because, as we've talked about, the government doesn't have any of its own money.
Yes.
It's all hard-working people's money.
Yes.
So it should not be the case that you can get rich off the backs of your own citizens. It makes me sick. But, you have to make systems that can account for human nature being bad instead of just dreaming up that it's good, flying a hammer and sickle and shooting anyone who disagrees.
Sebastian, thank you so much. That was a great hour of chat. I'm sure the listeners will enjoy it.
No,
I love how passionate you are about all of this stuff.
you managed to piss me off about economics.
I'm equally so. Don't worry. You're going to go read some Hayek and stay away from the Rousseau. thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And I think a good reminder of all the principles in the world that work and don't work. And perhaps some reading that our listeners can do. Do you just want to punt quickly? I know you on Instagram, you're doing something quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You've got like a little book club, basically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm surprised you found that. So I just, on my Instagram, it's Seb versus the world, just all underscore,
lowercase,
no underscores yet. And I do a lot of reading. I read about two or three books a week. So I thought to myself, I better start either making these ideas available for other people and putting recommendations out, or summarizing it in my own mind, or both. So that's what I'm doing. And if you like that, I guess, go see there. I've got a some good political philosophy books I'm going to review soon, although it takes me much longer to do that. But yeah, just check it out if you like books, I guess. Reading is important.
And you can also find Sebastian on Twitter, at Seb versus the World. Once again, thanks so much for coming on. Let me just wrap it up here. Thanks to all the listeners for listening to the show. As always, you can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report. You can find us on Facebook, both the page and the group. The group is where we have discussions about these kinds of topics that I've had a discussion with Sebastian for the last hour. And if you really enjoyed the show, or even if you didn't and you just want to throw money at us, we have a Patreon. You can find us on patreon.com/Renegade Report. Lastly, if you do listen through iTunes or even through the new Google app, please do leave us a rating. That does help us to get more listeners, because the show then gets recommended. And you can also recommend us to your friends and family. We are experiencing some rapid growth, which we really appreciate. Thanks so much, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.